hospitals around the country to pay their respects to the victims of a terrorist attack. High-ranking government and military officials, as well as citizens from all walks of life, attended a significant burial ceremony at the Holy Shrine in Shiraz, capital of Fars province.
I'm sharing the atmosphere of the past 50 days, the heaviest media battle against a government and a nation in the history of the world. Well, the result was that a part of the agents and officials, a part of our people, were now involved in these issues and disturbances and unrest in different strata, and they were harmed by it. And as I mentioned before, the officials and people in charge were committed to try as much as possible to reduce the damage. As for the damage caused by the riots in Fars province, thank God we had a very good operation with the correct understanding of the people and correct field management. I say this proudly, the city of Shiraz, God willing, will continue on this path. With correct understanding of the people's conditions, correct information, correct management of scenes and processes, we have experienced the least incidents of insecurity in Fars province.
Today, people with their fervent presence at the funeral prove that they are united, empathetic and want order and security. Government spokesman Ali Bahadur Jahrami told the media on the sidelines of the funeral ceremony. The participants held up photos of the martyrs, especially the children, and chanted slogans against the terrorists and their supporters. They also demanded that those behind the vicious act be brought to justice as soon as possible.
Regarding the riots, this has become very clear. Check the media and the conversations in general. It's quite clear that the President of the United States, Mr. Biden, officially announces that, unlike the previous governments, we support the unrest in Iran that President Raisi answered, that we will liberate Iran. It means that a government is speaking against an official government that is a member of the United Nations. Well, naturally, it's clear that these people provide the economic base of the unrest. They even use the maximum capacity in supplying necessities in lines and directions.
After the funeral procession in Shiraz, the bodies were flown to the northeastern city of Mashhad, which houses the shrine of the 8th Shia Imam, where tens of thousands of people bid farewell to the victims. That's all for today. Thanks from the whole team. Do tune in again at the same times next week and each week after. Bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
For quite a long time, Canada has played a relatively mild role in international politics. Once detached from it, Canada will encounter risks and pay a price. Canada should walk away from the shadows of Washington's politicians and make foreign policy based on its own interest. In this regard, we have provided a glimpse from world media websites. Stay tuned for more. Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, CBC, reported on November 6th that Canada will release a long-delayed Indo-Pacific strategy report. According to CBC, it's no accident that Canadian ministers have been traveling to Washington lately to talk about trading more with allies or even decoupling from China. Although the details of the report are not yet clear, CBC has suggested that the strategy as a whole is to look to Washington and that Ottawa's views on China are particularly similar to those espoused by U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. If so, it is disappointing and regrettable. The delay in the release of the strategy report is said to be due in large part to intense internal debate. A source told Canadian media that after the Meng Wanzhou incident, Justin Trudeau had hoped to make effort to repair relations with Beijing and suppress the idea and practice of decoupling from China's economy and trade. Ottawa has shown a tangled and complicated mindset for some time as to whether to put the China strategy into the new Indo-Pacific strategy or even let this Indo-Pacific strategy revolve around China and push Canada to the forefront of U.S. efforts to suppress China. Washington has shown clear impatience and dissatisfaction with Canada's silence on the Indo-Pacific strategy. David Cohen, the U.S. ambassador to Canada, said that everyone is waiting for Canada to release its framework for its overall China policy. The American magazine National Interest criticized Canada, a disappointingly meek U.S. ally, for taking a neutralist strategy on China. Under the influence of Washington, some Canadian politicians advocated that if allies lost the confidence, Canada may become a second-class citizen in the Five Eyes. Recently, Canada's increasingly negative moves toward China are obviously related to Washington's pressure. But as an independent sovereign country, Canada should have its own choices. Policymakers in Ottawa should be startled if they scrutinize the recent exclusive revelations from the Wall Street Journal and reflect on it from another angle. The radical politician in Washington, John Bolton, almost single-handedly instigated a violent storm between China and Canada, the impact of which continues to this day. A foreign politician's subjective malice toward China turned into Canada's malicious actions toward China unimpededly. Canada has become an American tool that has lost its self-will, and it has also tasted the taste of sandwich biscuits. How did such absurdity come about? Shouldn't this kind of remote control, which is unacceptable to any sovereign country, worthy of Canada's high alert and prompt Canada to adjust and avoid relevant decisions and action mechanisms? However, what people see now is that Canada still follows Washington's lead and takes the initiative to put itself in a cock position in the assembly line of Washington's suppression of China. Following this trend, Canada will be in a weaker or even humbler position in front of Washington if it walks in this direction. This is not the result that the vast majority of Canadians want to see. a certain extent, we understand Canada's circumstances. As a neighbor of the U.S., Canada is large but sparsely populated and is heavily dependent on the U.S., both economically and for security. It can be said that its lifeblood is tightly held in the hands of the U.S. regime. All along, Washington will not hesitate to pinch Canada when it needs to. But being under pressure from the U.S. is one thing. Taking the initiative to cater to the U.S. is another. Canada is not the only country that is coerced by the U.S. regime in terms of economy and security, but many countries have not voluntarily given up their insistence in pursuit of diplomatic independence. Canada used to strike a balance in the past. It shouldn't choose to strategically lie down just because Washington is piling more pressure on it. Canada is not the 51st state of the U.S. and has no obligation and should not be willing to be Washington's political tool and vassal. It is certain that if Canada follows the U.S. in its foreign strategy, its value as a sovereign state will be severely depreciated. This devaluation is actually already happening. Under the instigation of the U.S., Canada has recently launched a series of unfriendly actions against China, disrupting normal business cooperation between Chinese and Canadian companies in the name of national security, carrying out self-destructive pan-national security operations in the mutually beneficial economic and trade field will only harm Canada's economy, but will also further damage Canada's national reputation.
Say to America is be true to what you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witch hunt.
Turn here now.
We will resist.
I can't breathe. Help me. Please.
We the people.
Money changes everything. Money talks. Put your money where your mouth is. And nowhere are those proverbs more taken to heart than in U.S. elections, where billions of dollars are raised and spent. Big money is the name of the game in American politics today, and we're going to see just how this game is played.
Money drives votes.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to We the People. I am your host, Daniel Arya. Does money actually influence elections? Will billionaires have an outsized ability to control policy agenda? And does anyone see this as a threat to the future of representative democracy? Those are the questions we're trying to discuss in this episode. Now, as usual, we are pleased to have our two guests on our show, Christopher Halali, who ran for election to the U.S. Senate to represent the state of Vermont back in 2020, and Malik Abdul, a political commentator who is joining us out of Washington. Stay tuned.
How strong is the association between campaign spending and political success? For House seats, more than 90% of candidates who spend the most win. From 2000 through 2016, there was only one election cycle where that wasn't true, 2010. In that election, 86% of the top spenders won. So, in a nutshell, you can say there is a good chance that if you spend more money, you win.
Now, this year, the money has been coming in and out of political campaigns at a particularly furious pace. The total cost of the 2022 federal midterm elections is projected to reach almost a record $9.3 billion. Now, that's almost $2 billion more than the amount spent in 2018. So why are midterm elections becoming so dang costly?
I think fundamentally, the midterm elections are proving to be major battlegrounds for political power and influence in the American political system. And what we're seeing is a tremendous amount of effort and millions of dollars being spent in campaigns that before in states where you wouldn't have that kind of money. And it's really because the margins of power and control in both the House of Representatives and the Senate are so small that only flipping one or two or a handful of seats means the other party getting control of that body. So ultimately, what we are seeing is we're seeing a ton of money, special interests, lobbyists coming in and pouring into these campaigns in some races that nobody was really caring about just 4 or 8 years ago or 10 years ago.
So the amount of money flowing in from billionaires and huge lobbying groups to fund candidates running in the next midterm elections has also busted all previous records, $1.3 billion. Now, that is a very big number, and by the way, it is not under the table. That's how campaign financing works in America. So shouldn't this practice be illegal, since, of course, these candidates, when elected, will have to do something in return for this money, right?
A new study has found that the total cost of 2022 midterm elections is projected to reach almost $10 billion. I'm not opposed to billions of dollars being spent in political campaigns because there are some people who do better than others, but I think we do need to pay more attention to the dark money, because if we have, there may be some dark money group funding campaigns that have associations with people or organizations or places that don't work for the American people or working against the American people. So, okay, yes, fine with money in politics, even billions being spent in politics, but I do think that there needs to be more regulations, or I would be supportive of regulations around.
Political expenditures have changed dramatically over the past few elections. In 2000, outside spending on political campaigns was roughly $50 million. So, what changed? Well, in January of 2010, the US Supreme Court ruled in a case known as Citizens United, which basically allowed unlimited political spending by individuals and corporations. The way this works is that although the law sets a limit on contributions directly to a candidate, there is no limit to indirect candidate contributions.
Lobbyist groups and things like that can give money to campaigns, exorbitant amounts to campaigns, through other means available to them. And ultimately, this boils down to issues of, fundamentally in our system, that corporations and those kind of interests have personhood under the law. So they are able to contribute in that way. There are many calls to make that illegal. And ultimately, it is true that those candidates who take money, be it from pharmaceutical companies, military-industrial complex like the weapons manufacturers, from prisons, especially private prisons, from various entities out there, be they oil, gas, whatever they might be, that they are ultimately beholden to those interests.
Although big spenders are not allowed to coordinate with the candidate directly, this rule is clearly and openly ineffective. The donated money is spent on things like events and staff salaries, but generally, about 75% of funds go toward direct advertising, like mail, radio, television, and internet ads. So, what about the candidates that get fewer funds? What are their odds of winning?
I think that you can more often than not say that those who spend more money get elected. However, there are many examples where that isn't the case. For example, during the Democratic primary, just the last election cycle, Michael Bloomberg spent hundreds of millions of dollars on his campaign, and he went really nowhere. It was eventually Joe Biden who went forward, who spent a fraction of the money that Mr. Bloomberg had put in. I think ultimately it's a combination of money, but also some of the issues and the zeitgeist of, you know, the current times that really propel certain candidates and parties to elected office.
Now, individual donors contributing $200 or less account for a greater share of money raised by federal candidates in this year's midterm elections. Now, those small donors make up 21% of all funds raised by candidates and political committees. So what are the incentives for these small donors?
You know that candidates often tout the amount of money that they've seen from small donors. In fact, if you're trying to get some of those big dollar donations, then strategists and the campaign staff alike, they are going to tout the amount of money that you've gotten from small donors. The importance of that is that being able to say that you've had, you know, you may have 50,000, and this is just a number, 50,000 small donors donating to your campaign, what that means at a practical level is that there's a certain amount of momentum that you have backing you.
The rise of small donors in itself can raise hope that this increasing group can act as a counterbalance against the powerful lobbyists and mega donors, but it is not that easy. Because to be a candidate that can attract a sizable small donation, you need a lot of media visibility in the first place, and that media visibility most of the times needs donors who could cover your finances for media shows and ads.
There are a lot of small donors who want to give the maximum amount to certain candidates that they find will carry their interests. And then there are those small donors who give small amounts because they might be working class or working poor, and they want to see an insurgent candidate win the primary or win their race. So ultimately, you have these two sides, be they the corporate candidate, someone like Joe Biden or the Michael Bloombergs like we talked about, or even the Donald Trumps. And then you have the insurgent candidates, someone like Bernie Sanders, who comes in and has a lot of contributions from smaller donations made by working class people to achieve, you know, an insurgent candidacy to change fundamental policies and the structure of how things are done in the United States. More often, of course, in history, the moneyed interests and those donations that come from the big dollar donors are the ones that get ahead. But Bernie Sanders' campaign showed historically that there is an opening. And also the same is true on Donald Trump's side, who got a lot of money, not only from major donations, but from a lot of working class people because of some key issues that he spoke about. So we're seeing a rise of populism here. And I think that that's evident in the donations that the candidates are getting.
In the United States, campaign season begins long before elections. These longer campaign seasons necessitate major fundraising just to keep them alive. Now, it seems as if for House lawmakers and the short two-year term that they have, the top concern is to raise money in the first year and spend it the second year. Do you agree?
Yes. With those two-year election cycles, it does mean that lawmakers are, as soon as they raise the money, they spend the next year trying to spend the money in anticipation of the next campaign. Because if you think about it, 2 years, you only have 2 years. So if you're running every 2 years, you run your campaign, you get in office that first year, try to get some things done. But by the second year, you're already into your second campaign season of sorts. So that next year, you're running another campaign. And so you need more donors. You need a whole campaign apparatus, and you have to do this over and over and over again every 2 years.
Few things in life are more predictable than the chances of an incumbent member of the U.S. House of Representatives winning re-election. The incumbent's re-election rate in Congress is well over 90%, sometimes even as close as 98 or 99. So, walk us through the big picture. Why spend so much money to send pretty much the same group of people to the Congress?
Why? Well, there's one thing. There's something to the idea that people vote for those whom they like. In some cases, they vote for those whom they like less. We have people in office because consider a person who's been in office for 15 years or 20 years or something. Why do you keep electing them into office? Many of them, the idea is that if you get in office, especially at the federal level, if you get in office, then there are things that you're able to do for your community. So if you are in, for instance, a college town or a manufacturing town or an agricultural town, you may pour money into the local college. You may be able to get money to fund a manufacturing plant, or you may be able to get money for farmers or things like that. Those are the things that politicians do, and we call them earmarks. So you're able to earmark a certain amount of money that goes towards your particular pet project.
A number of arguments have been put forward to explain the high rate of incumbency re-election or the so-called congressional stagnation. Candidates that are re-elected are said to be more experienced, that is to say, they have run a successful campaign before. They have also had media coverage, which gives them name recognition, but if you look at these factors closely, all of them come down to one thing: money.
Especially outside the United States, to understand, the Democratic and the Republican parties are two sides of the same coin. Both are ruling class parties, capitalist parties, that ultimately perpetuate their own power and interests. That they both spend so much money and criticize themselves in public means only that they play golf together and smoke cigars in their back rooms in private. Both of them profit tremendously off of this system. They spend hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, on election cycles, but reap in tens of billions of dollars in the various gifts, donations, and power that they achieve through that. So they're able to give tax breaks to the rich. They're able to change restrictions on certain provisions, be they for environmental issues or for gas and fracking and things like that. They're able to give tremendous wealth back to the lobbyists and provide them with the legislation needed for them to increase their power and their wealth. So ultimately, what we see in the United States is that is a show. It's not really democracy. It's a show of a fake democracy that parades itself around as being the penultimate democratic country, when it's really a one-party state. And that party is, of course, the corporate party.
Now, Congress is the least most popular branch of government, with approvals in recent years sharply lower, generally in the 10 to 20% range. So if Congress is so unpopular, then why do we have so many small donors and also such a high percentage of re-election rates?
I think here it's important to understand and separate Congresspersons, representatives and senators, from the actual institution of the Congress or the Senate and House of Representatives that comprise the Congress. A lot of people are very committed to individual congresspersons who are of their political ideology, who uphold the banner of many of the causes that they believe in, whereas most Americans think that the institution is broken and doesn't enact the will of the people.
It's a common refrain that Americans may not like what Congress overall is doing, but they like the job their own member of Congress is doing. Indeed, it's true that approval for individual congressmen is almost always significantly higher than it is for either the House or Senate.
I think it's important to understand that there are many people who are committed to their political side. For example, those on the Democratic side with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and those on the Republican side, for example, with someone like Marjorie Taylor Greene. And then you have the similar phenomena with the Supreme Court, which I think is important. That is why you still have so many people spending so much money and being so passionate about individuals, but the institution as a whole has very poor approval overall, just like the Supreme Court and other institutions of the U.S. government, where key individuals are beloved by some on that political side, but the institution as a whole is not.
Now, the list of the top 10 mega donors shows that they have spent an unbelievable sum of $500 million. Now, these people actually go freelancing on their own, deciding which candidates they want to see in the Senate or the House. Moreover, only about 32,000 people, or just 1% of 1% of the U.S. population, contributes $1 billion, or nearly 30% of the money to the campaign. So what could be done to stop the cycle of money drives a vote?
I think ultimately the number one priority to have clean elections in the United States is to bar all corporate donations and all lobbying, really, from the political cycle. Political elections are for the representatives of the people, not for the representatives of the corporations, of big business, of the monopolies, and so on. So ultimately, if we are to have really democratic elections, first it requires that all of these corporations and lobbying groups are out of the political life in their totality. So unless that happens, unless there is some way, some mechanism, some law that can be passed and enacted where corporations are not allowed to give this amount of money and are not allowed to partake in the political process and political life of this country, you will never have clean elections. You will never have politicians who are really dedicated to the people.
I think that what can be done is we can do more things to place some regulations around the dark money in politics, because I do believe that we should know, with political campaigns, I believe that we should know where the money is coming from. So that's an important point. What will ultimately be done about it? I don't think a whole lot, because politicians on both sides, whether it's a Republican or Democrat, they all benefit from big money.
When 1% of 1% of the population provides almost 30% of the money in elections, you can bet that this amount of money pulls lawmakers away from the will of the majority and into the narrow interests of their donors, friends, and billionaires.
Money, it doesn't always equal victory, but it usually does. The steep price of a seat means that when elected, representatives soon learn that if they want to retain their seats, they have to cater to the 1% of the 1% group. So what is left out in the process are ordinary Americans who are becoming more disgruntled at an institution that is supposed to be the symbol of democracy and representation in the United States. And now it's time to see what Abbas Montarim has prepared for us this week.
Elections in America never truly represent the will of the people. And that's because elections are never free nor fair, as billions upon billions of dollars are spent on elections every election cycle, and candidates are essentially bought and paid for by corporations, making it nearly impossible for a candidate truly guided by egalitarian and communalistic values to ever get elected. And if elections never truly represent the will of the people, that means that politicians don't represent the people either. On this segment of Power to the People, we is going to take a look at the election spending and how money is in politics in America and how it supports American corporate domination. If we look at the recent 2020 election cycle, a record-breaking $14.4 billion was spent. And while all that money was spent on corporations and political interest groups getting politicians elected, the people in America, they didn't get no free healthcare or no free college, and there's over 500,000 people sleeping on the streets. And you know, America, it claims to be a democracy, yet Americans, they don't even get to choose or even vote on how there's a mass amount of money spent on sponsoring politicians' campaigns. Corporations spend billions upon billions of dollars getting their candidates elected so that they can have corporate influence and control over politics that allow their companies to exploit the people and rake in mass profits. This keeps the capitalist order running, as well as transnational corporate companies in control globally. And it doesn't just stop with elections. As big corporations, they continue to buy politicians once they are elected, as these corporations will do everything and anything to keep their control. An example of this is the pharmaceutical industry, where over two-thirds of Congress cashed a pharmaceutical campaign check in 2020. So now Big Pharma effectively has control over Congress, and they're able to pass laws that are favorable to pharmaceutical companies. Aside from politicians taking big checks from these pharmaceutical companies, these politicians, they also make big money on the stock market. Politicians, they are literally privy to certain financial information before things happen, allowing them to get away with insider trading while also being able to use their job as plausible deniability. The Pelosi's, for example, an official and a high-ranking politician. So of course she would know about the shutdown that's about to happen and the big spending that was going to be put into the pharmaceutical industry. And the Pelosi's themselves, they aren't the only ones that are doing this and getting rich. A recent New York Times investigation found that at least 97 current members of Congress bought or sold stock, bonds, or other financial assets that aligned with their work as so-called politicians. So it's very clear that big corporations fund their politicians to get elected, and fund politicians while they are elected to maintain corporate control over the United States government, or rather, the United Corporations of America. And we have to take big money out of politics, but that requires ending capitalism and freeing the land from Euro-American colonial control, which values profit over anything and everything. This is Power to the People. I'm Abbas Muntakeem.
And that was our show, everyone. I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and you join us again next time for another episode of We the People. Goodbye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All Compassionate, the All Merciful. Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. As you know, we have embarked on explanation of Surah Hashr, which is number 59 in the serial order of compilation of the Noble Quran. It has 24 ayahs and was revealed in Medina. Its name is derived from the second ayah, which mentions the word Hashr, which does not, however, denote the gathering on the Day of Resurrection, but it connotes people's gathering for migration. The surah opens and closes with the glorification of God Almighty by all that is in the role of existence. It mainly refers to the collaboration of the Arab hypocrites with the Israelite tribes in Medina against the Muslims, and the banishment of the Jewish tribe of Banu Nadir for its breaking of the agreement with the Prophet. The Almighty Creator says that the joint stratagems of the hypocrites and the rebellious Israelites lead to nothing but their humiliation and defeat. We start from where we left you last Friday, and here are ayahs 11, 12, and 13.
أَلَمْ تَرَ إِلَى الَّذِينَ نَافَقُوا يَقُولُونَ لِإِخْوَانِهِمُ الَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا مِنْ أَهْلِ الْكِتَابِ لَئِنْ أُخْرِجْتُمْ لَنَخْرُجَنَّ مَعَكُمْ وَلَا نُطِيعُ فِيكُمْ أَحَدًا أَبَدًا وَإِنْ قُوتِلْتُمْ لَنَنْصُرَنَّكُمْ وَاللَّهُ يَشْهَدُ إِنَّهُمْ لَكَاذِبُونَ لئن أخرجوا لا يخرجون معهم ولئن قوتلوا لا ينصرونهم ولئن نصروهم ليولن الأدبار ثم لا ينصرون لأنتم أشد رهبة في صدورهم من الله ذلك بأنهم قوم لا يفقهون.
Have you not regarded the hypocrites who say to their brethren, the faithless from among the people of the book, if you are expelled, we will surely go out with you, and we will never obey anyone against you, and if you are fought against, we will surely help you. And Allah bears witness that they are indeed liars. Surely, if they were expelled, they would not go out with them. And if they were fought against, they would not help them. And even if they were to help them, they would surely turn their backs to flee, and then they would not be helped. Indeed, they have a greater awe of you in their hearts than of Allah. That is because they are a lot who do not understand. If you might recall, last week, in our explanation of the previous ayahs of Surah Hashr, we said the boundaries of time and place are not important in religious brotherhood, and it is the duty of believers to assist their brethren in faith who have been displaced from homes and to help them settle in the new land. We also said that it is faith in God and removal of all negative attitudes from the hearts that makes a person deserving of divine mercy and kindness. Hence, sins are forgiven when repentance in the divine court is earnest and sincere. The ayahs which we now recited refer to the hypocrites and disbelievers who profess unity against believers, But when action is required, they are too timid to come out in the field. It happened that when the Prophet ordered the Israeli tribes to leave Medina for their breach of the pact of neutrality, a group of Arab hypocrites who outwardly paid lip service to Islam but were disbelievers at heart sent a message telling them to prepare for battle against Muslims. These hypocrites promised to fight along with the Israelites against Muslims, and in case of suffering defeat, to leave Medina in company of those being expelled. The hypocrites were led by Ibn Ubay and Ibn Nabtal. Here, the Noble Quran is explicitly saying that God Almighty bears witness that the hypocrites are liars and will not keep their promise. Thus, when the Israelites had no other choice but to leave, the Arab hypocrites neither supported them nor left Medina along with them. From these ayahs, we learn that, number one, the faithful are brothers of each other, while the hypocrites profess brotherhood with the faithless and with the enemies of Islam. Number two, lies, deceit, and cowardliness are among the main features of the hypocrites. Number three, a believer should not fear the deceptive and disappointing words of the hypocrites, whose main intention is to demoralize the true Muslims. And number four, being afraid of people rather than of Allah is an explicit sign of hypocrisy. Now we invite you to listen to ayahs 14 and 15 of the same surah.
لا يقاتلونكم جميعا إلا في قرى محصنة أو من وراء جدر بأسهم بينهم شديد تحسبهم جميعا وقلوبهم شتى ذلك بأنهم قوم لا يعقلون كمثل الذين من قبلهم قريبا ذاقوا وبال أمرهم ولهم عذاب أليم.
They will not fight against you together except in fortified townships or from behind walls. Their might is great amongst themselves. You suppose them to be united, but their hearts are disunited. That is because they are a lot who do not apply reason. Just like those who tasted the evil consequences of their deeds recently before them, and there is a painful punishment for them. These ayahs mean to say the hypocrites are so afraid of the believers that in case of confrontation, they hide behind walls and wage war against them from fortified places. Muslims might think the hypocrites are united amongst themselves, but the fact is that they're not, and have deep differences with each other because of their basic ignorance of truth and realities. True believers are cautioned against cooperation with the hypocrites, since this would mean falling to deception, which entails torment in life and terrible punishment in the hereafter. Thus, those who go astray taste the bitter consequences of their error, similar to the fate of the disbelievers and hypocrites of the past, which means favorable and unfavorable things are the consequences of our own deeds. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number one, if the true believers, we trust in God, stand united against the enemies, the Almighty will cast fear in the hearts of enemies, making them retreat or surrender. Number two, superficial and outward unity among the different groups of hypocrites and disbelievers will not last long, since real unity is based on divine values. And number three, the fate of the past nations should serve as admonishment for us and for the coming generations. In conclusion of this week's episode of Path Towards Enlightenment, here are ayahs 16 and 17 of Surah Hashr.
كمثل الشيطان إذ قال للإنسان اكفر فلما كفر قال إني بريء منك إني أخاف الله رب العالمين فكان عاقبتهما أنهما في النار خالدين فيها وذلك جزاء الظالمين.
The hypocrites are like Satan when he tells mankind to disbelieve. When that person disbelieves, he says, "Indeed, I am absolved of you. Indeed, I fear Allah, the Lord of all the worlds." So the fate of both is that they will be in the fire, to remain in it forever. And such is the requital of the wrongdoers. Here, the believers are reminded of yet another attribute of the hypocrites, that is, they resemble Satan, who uses different designs to tempt people but does not keep his promise after people have gone astray by citing his own fears of the Almighty Creator of the universe. Ayah 17 refers to the fate of Satan and his followers, that is, they will abide in the fires of hell forever. These ayahs teach us that, number one, hypocrisy makes a person devilish to the extent that he or she embarks on deceiving others and trying in vain to escape the misery in which they have trapped themselves. Number two, the Satan and the hypocrites break promises by citing fear of God, which is actually a pretext to try to escape the dire consequences of their own evil deeds. And number three, the ever-deceiving Satan never gives up his temptations, while the hypocrites should be considered devils in human for their deceiving of simple-minded people.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Faith through action. Sunday, the 5th of Ramadan, 1394, the 22nd of September, 1974. God chose the people best prepared for His most important mission. If you look amongst yourselves, you will see that one of you looks more determined in appearance, stronger in physique, and more healthy looking in complexion. His hand is stronger, his arms are more powerful, his chest is broader. You'd ask that guy to help you carry a heavy load. You'd choose him for this task, and he'd probably rush to help too. So, if he was chosen, if he could undertake this task, meaning if he wanted to do it, because he definitely could do it, if he decided that he would carry this load, then he would stand out from his peers. You would say, poor guy, no one else could do it, so we didn't ask them. Instead, we asked you. When Allah chose the nation of Islam or the Israelites, it was in this sense. At their own time, the Israelites and the Muslims were the most able people to bear the responsibility of the divine mission of leading and guiding mankind. This is why Allah entrusted them with this mission. Did they bear it faithfully or not? If they did, they would have carried this trust to its destination, and they would have been the best and most worthy of the Muslims. But if they didn't, then what? If they didn't, then they are in the same situation as the Israelites, who did not fulfill the trust that Allah placed in them. So they were struck with abasement and poverty, and they earned God's wrath. The Quran, Surah 2, verse 61. This is in this world, and their refuge is hell. This is in the hereafter.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
He chose you to bear this responsibility and has not placed for you any obstacle in the religion. He has not created any difficulty or hardship in the religion for you. This responsibility is not excessively burdensome. Being chosen is not a punishment. You are capable of bearing this duty. The faith of your father, Ibrahim. This is the same faith as that of Ibrahim. He named you Muslims before and now. This refers to Ibrahim's supplication in Surah Baqarah, and from our progeny a nation submissive to you. The Quran, Surah 2, verse 128. So God is saying that He gave them this name before and also now. Why? For what reason? In order that you do what? So that the apostle may be a witness to you, and that you may be witnesses to mankind. So that the prophet will be responsible for you, and you will be responsible for mankind. So that the prophet watches over you and witnesses what you do, and so that you will watch over mankind and witness what they do.
You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is IRIB English Radio.